Facebook page if you want to look that up. And I will try to link to that on this page for Wednesday Talk Radio and some of the books and other information. So thank you so much for listening. This has been Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Roland. Coming up, more great programming here on KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a feature-length documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein on Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st at Cinema 21 in Portland. Gaining Ground tells the stories of farmers making extraordinary changes in their farming practice so they can feed their local communities sustainably grown produce and grains. The documentary interweaves experiences of urban farmer activists, large farms in transition, and small family farmers. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Wednesday, September 30th, and Thursday, October 1st, at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What are you doing this Thursday at 11 a.m.? Hopefully you're listening to Between the Covers, where I talk with living legend, author of over 60 books, Ursula K. Le Guin. Le Guin says, "You can't change society without changing the English language." Thus, her new book, For Writers, Steering the Craft, inevitably engages class, gender, capitalism, politics, and morality, which for her is not separate from grammar and punctuation. Again, it's
Ursula K. Le Guin
this Thursday at 11 on
KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, 90.7 FM in Portland.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01, and coming up next, it's Political Perspectives, where we speak with Caroline Frederickson about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Near the end of the hour, we'll also hear from musician, activist Lori Dameron about What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth, her multimedia environmental concert coming to Portland. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with Palestinian community organizer and Amnesty International prisoner of conscience, Bassem Tamimi. And we'll hear excerpts from the documentary Occupation 101 about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Eric Tegetoff speaks with journalist and novelist Hector Tobar about his latest book, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. And at 11:30, Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News investigates the world's biggest oil company, ExxonMobil. Starting in the 1970s, Exxon knew their product would damage the climate, but chose to fund denial. And thank you, KBOO members, for your support in our recent fall membership drive. If you missed it, you can still become a member at kboo.fm. Just click on Donate Today. And now, Political Perspectives. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. My guest is Caroline Frederickson. She is president of the American Constitution Society. Before joining ACS, Caroline served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office and as general counsel and legal director of NARAL, Pro-Choice America. She practiced several years as a labor lawyer. In addition, she was chief of staff to Senator Maria Cantwell and deputy chief of staff to then-Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle. During the Clinton administration, Caroline served as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. Caroline is also a senior fellow at Demos. We are talking about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Welcome, Caroline Frederickson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very nice to have you here while you're in Portland. Thank you. What prompted you to write about the struggles of American women in the workplace, particularly low-income women and women of color?
You know, the thing that I really wanted to get on the table was the real story that we need to be talking about, which is not about leaning in. It's not about opting out. What I had was a reaction to how dominant the narrative was, the narrative that focused really solely on high-earning, almost all white women, and the struggles that they face in the corporate boardroom when they want to speak up and a male colleague talks over them, and our need as women to develop our own self-esteem and self-motivation to have confidence to speak up in those situations. And then there was the other narrative that was the kind of counter to that, that was women in these high-earning positions really just can't do it all. Let's just recognize we can't do it all, and let's opt out and stay home and take care of our kids. Okay, so that may be a conversation that's relevant to a very, very small number of women. But really, let's talk about what really is important for those women who can't lean in and can't opt out. They can't lean in because they'll get fired as soon as they do. They can't opt out because they have to earn a living. They have to pay for childcare. They have to pay the rent. There's just not an option for women to leave the workforce and sit back and let somebody else pay all their bills.
And you also described the story of your great-grandmother in the very beginning of the book and how she inspired some of this work.
She did. Well, you know, I wrote my college essays when I was applying to college. I had this story about my great-grandmother, and she came from Sweden as a teenager. It was this incredibly terrible, sad story. She had left her widowed father behind. All of her younger siblings had died. He saw no future for her in Sweden and said, you know, you're going to go to America. And so she did. She got on a boat. She came, steerage. She got a job as a scullery maid in Boston. She basically was working in the kitchen of wealthy families, scrubbing dishes, cleaning pots and pans. And she had an incredibly tough life. But it seemed like, to me, as a kid, that it was sort of ancient history, that her story was something that was really not that relevant, and that it was a great kind of historical view. And unfortunately, as I did more and more research for this book, and as I've been involved in politics, I see that the reality is that for many women in America, things haven't changed. The fact was, my great-grandmother, Matilda, came to the United States with no legal rights. She couldn't protest against sexual harassment. She couldn't protest if she was discriminated against. She couldn't protest if her wages were stolen from her. But the fact of the matter is there are women like her now, like Sonia Suarez, who is in Boston, just like my great-grandmother. She's also a domestic worker, and she was brave enough to testify in front of the Massachusetts state legislature. And she talked about facing the exact same circumstances that Matilda Olofsson faced at the end of the 19th century. All of those things are still legal, basically, in terms of how certain workers are treated. And so I wanted to put that on the table, that we have a lot of work to do to make sure that all workers, and women particularly, and low-wage women of color especially, are protected by our laws.
And there is, in the introduction, you have a list of statistics, about six or so statistics that are quite alarming about certain statistics about women workers right now. But I wonder if you would mind going over that with us.
Sure. Well, these are numbers that they were surprising to me as well. And as you mentioned, I was a labor lawyer. I've worked in labor and employment policy on the progressive side for most of my career. So these statistics, I think, help people understand better, you know, what is really going on in our economy and how what we often call women's issues are really economic issues. And if we don't see them that way, we are not going to solve the problems in our issue of income inequality. So women are now 63.9% of breadwinners or co-breadwinners in American families. Women are 63% of minimum wage workers. In 2013, 16.8 million women earned less than $11 an hour. Women are 73% of tipped employees, which includes waiters, manicurists, and hairdressers. These workers, in most parts of the country, make only $2.13 an hour. Women are 86% of personal care aides, a profession that is expected to grow 49% from 2012 to 2022. And within that category, they are 94% of childcare workers and 88% of home health aides. Women are 35% of the 10.3 million independent contractors. And women are 63% of part-time workers.
That's quite an array of statistics that we might be led to forget with some of the media
experience. Well, it's very true, and I think it's important. The fight for 15, the fight for the minimum wage increase across the country is an issue that is very much central to women's economic well-being in this country. Women are the majority, the two-thirds almost, of minimum wage workers. So an increase in the minimum wage is something that goes to the bottom line of where women stand in our economy.
Now, one basic point of under the bus that is that over the years, laws enacted to protect workers have left some behind, many of them women. Can you explain what that general point applies
yes.
to?
Yes. Well, you know, and this is something, you know, again, as I was doing research for Under the Bus, I felt some amount of chagrin myself for not having known about where the holes were in our employment and labor laws. As I mentioned, I was a labor and employment lawyer. After that, I did labor and employment policy on Capitol Hill. I actually drafted legislation, including the Paycheck Fairness Act and other pieces of legislation that were based on existing protective labor laws, never once thinking to re-examine why it was that certain professions or certain size employers were carved out. But when I went back and looked at it for this book, Under the Bus, I began to see an incredibly, incredibly horrific story, which is basically this. I mean, everybody knows that legislation involves deal-making. During the New Deal, the deal-making was between President Roosevelt and his allies and reactionary, misogynistic, and racist forces embodied by the Dixiecrats from the South who wanted to protect an economy that in the South was still living the legacy of slavery, was still a plantation economy that depended on nearly slave labor of primarily African Americans, women and men. And what they wanted to make sure was that their workforce did not have the minimum wage, did not get overtime when they worked more than 40 hours a week, did not have the ability to join a union, and at that time did not get Social Security. All of the different protections that were negotiated for other workers were not available for them. And I had cause to look at the congressional record and to see how explicit that conversation was. One of the members of Congress, his nickname was actually Cotton. Cotton Ed Smith talked about God's gift to the South, which was basically being undercut by these protective labor laws. So essentially he was saying slavery was God's gift to the South. And so what happened was that those workers were carved out. Domestic workers, farm workers, a whole array of other workers that, guess what, happened to be dominated by workers of color. Many of them were women. And as we went through the 20th century, we adopted more laws that either based on those laws, the Fair Labor Standards Act is the minimum wage and overtime law. The Equal Pay Act is an amendment to that bill. Then we adopted Title VII, which is the anti-discrimination law. And in the negotiations over that law, it was clear that the dynamic was, okay, it's one thing to prevent a large employer up there in the North from discriminating, because after all, they're big enough, they can have separate divisions, right? You don't really have to have that mixing. But very clearly and very explicitly on the record, they talked about the small business in the South particularly as being a family structure. And God forbid you have mixing. God forbid you have mixing. And so that is the reason why small businesses are exempted. It's not because there was as much of a concern about the cost of imposed on small business. And actually, what would the cost be of evaluating applicants for a job fairly based on their skills as opposed to their race? But putting that aside, the issue was they didn't think it was appropriate to have black folks and white folks in the same company working side by side. Those size-based exemptions have then found their way into any number of other subsequent laws. And so what we live with now is that there are a whole set of laws that just don't protect. A lot of women and minorities work in small businesses. And in those small businesses, the employers can hire them and say, you know what? I'm going to pay you less than the white guy over there, and that's legal. So I think we need to understand how these things continue to play out and how many women, particularly low-wage women, continue to be not protected by the discrimination laws, not enabled to get even the minimum wage, not entitled to overtime when they work 40 hours a week, and not protected if they want to join a union. They try and join a union, they can be fired from the get-go.
Right. So even the sort of standard that we all think of as holy, Social Security, has some of the limitations.
It did initially. And Social Security had both exclusions for domestic and farm workers, again, black workers in the South working on those plantations. But it also had administration of Social Security was put in local hands. At the lobbying, because of the lobbying of the Dixiecrats, they wanted to administer it locally. And when it was administered locally in the South, it was not administered fairly by any means. So you already had these large number of African-American workers carved out of Social Security. That has been fixed. So I want to put that on the record. But at the same time, they had local administration of Social Security benefits. So at the time, African-American workers didn't get any Social Security.
And you mentioned the other ones, just to kind of briefly summarize. National Labor Relations Act also has limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Fair Labor Standards Act. The Fair Housing Act, I think you talk about as having limitations.
It does, in fact. And it's just a terrible thing. It's called the Mrs. Murphy's exemption. I mean, that was sort of the way it was described, which I think really does a disservice to Irish Americans, who I wouldn't want to assume they're all racist. By any stretch, I'm being married to one. But the fact of the matter was that the Fair Housing Act was the sort of template for what happened in the fair employment context, which was to say landlords shouldn't be expected, if they have a small building, to rent to people who aren't of their race. And I find that shocking. I find that shocking now. It should have been shocking then. Senator Mondale, when he was in the Senate, actually reacted to, you know, some of this and talking about how painful it was to have to support these exemptions as part of a political deal, knowing full well that exempting small businesses and exempting small landlords was all about race. And it was all about preventing people of color, and now in this context, women of color primarily, from having access to the same kind of jobs, the same kind of housing that white people have. And the white men particularly. And then these exemptions live on and continue to play out in people's lives. And we don't talk about them because they've been in the law for so long.
I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson. We're talking about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. What about the right to sue if the employer does something wrong? How universal is that these days?
Well, I mean, there are workers who don't have a right to sue. So as I mentioned, there are these workers who just aren't protected by the law. So if you're a domestic worker, I would say, so as a footnote, President Obama has been working hard to fix the situation of domestic workers. And they're primarily home health aides now. It's an enormously, as we talked about, enormously growing profession because of the aging of the American population. Home health aides also care for disabled people who are covered by Medicaid. It's a growing profession, almost all women, many of them women of color, many immigrant women. And so the president has been working to try and ensure that they even get the minimum wage. I mean, it's shocking that they wouldn't get the minimum wage at a basis, which is not generous enough, let alone overtime. But they have not been covered by the minimum wage and overtime law. So if they were not being paid fairly, there's no recourse for them. Farm workers don't get overtime. And then you have all these workers, as I mentioned, in smaller companies who can be freely discriminated against and have no legal rights under the federal law. But their courts and Congress have also imposed any number of other barriers that make it really hard to enforce rights in the courts. And, you know, I could get into all kind of technical details about how the courts are kind of rolling up the carpet. If you don't know everything about why you were discriminated and how you were discriminated, if your employer doesn't basically tell you, I'm paying you less because you're a black woman, if they don't tell you that and you don't have it written down, it's almost impossible to even get past the first hurdle to get into court. And then there are all sorts of other reasons why it's just difficult. Mm-hmm. In the context of the Fair Labor Standards Act, when, say, workers have been denied, this often happens in the restaurant industry where the tipped wage is $2.13 an hour. And that's federally. Oregon, happily, does not have a tipped wage. Restaurant workers tipped employees are supposed to get the full minimum wage, plus then tips on top. For the rest of the country, most of the rest of the country, it's $2.13. And in a theory, the tips are supposed to bring you up to at least the minimum wage. Well, that often doesn't happen. And when workers sue, the remedy is just back pay. So it's almost barely worth it, right? So for an employer to say, if I don't pay you your full wage, and then you sue me, all I have to do is pay you back your full wage. So why wouldn't you? So the remedies are incredibly weak. And I think it's just another area where we tend to think we have these pretty strong laws. But in fact, we have huge gaps in terms of who's covered. And then we have an incredibly weak enforcement mechanism for those who are privileged enough to even have access to legal protection.
Yeah. Some people, I've heard this within the last few weeks when someone was taking a job that and she anticipated she might face some discrimination. She said, well, I'll just file a complaint with the EEOC. What's that? What are the standards like there?
Well, so there are a couple of things I want to say. One is that an increasing trend is employees are being asked to sign arbitration agreements. This is going on across the country. And you may notice, those of you who are listening, when you sign up to get a cell phone or any other type of product, you often have to sign a contract that deep in the details of all that tiny, tiny little print that you probably don't read and nobody does because it's so long and it's so complicated, you're giving up your right to sue. You may not know this, but you are. And so look at that contract. More and more employers are now forcing potential employees to sign the same kind of contract so that you could be discriminated against. You could go work for some big company, and they could say, Kathleen, we're going to pay you less because you're a woman. We just are. And you have evidence, and you want to bring a lawsuit. And they would say, so sorry, we know you have a protected right under the law, but you have signed away your right to sue. So we could go to arbitration. By the way, I will choose the arbitrator. I will choose where we have arbitration. And guess what? The arbitrator gets hired by me, the company, repeatedly. And so therefore, the arbitrator might actually be a little bit more inclined to my point of view than your point of view. And so that is an incredibly problematic situation where we have a private companies taking away public rights. The legislation that was fought so hard for to protect people's rights, that if you want to have a job, you basically have to say, okay, I give up my right to go to court. The EEOC, for those who can actually proceed with a suit, is just doing its best, but its resources are tiny. They've been cut back very deeply, but they try. But it's just they have such a small budget compared to the number of complaints. I would say one of the interesting things that's happened, which shows, where one of the big problems are in the law, is in the area of pregnancy discrimination. They've had a huge increase in the number of claims for pregnancy discrimination because employers are rather blatantly telling women who are either thinking about getting pregnant, are pregnant, were pregnant, they're not going to hire them, or they're going to fire them, or they're going to demote them, or they're going to cut their pay. So that's one of the big issues that they're dealing with right now. But they're just swamped. Swamped, unfortunately, underfunded, underbudgeted federal agency.
So you mentioned, you made reference earlier to the Fair Pay Act. That's the Harkin bill?
Yes, the Fair Pay Act, as opposed to the Equal Pay Act, which is law on the books, which is that amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act I talked about, which doesn't protect the workers who are exempted. The Fair Pay Act was something that former Senator Harkin had introduced, which I think it's something we really need to talk about. His bill would have addressed what we call occupational segregation. And that's a situation where categories of jobs that are dominated by women are systematically paid less than jobs that are dominated by men. And it's seen as just a choice. Mm-hmm. At least the right would characterize it as a choice that women make to go into professions that earn less. Whereas I think those of us on the progressive side would argue that this is another example of discrimination, because why is it that jobs that are of equal value in terms of the skills that are required, in terms of the education that is required, are paid less on a systematic basis because women hold those? But so it's jobs like nursing. It's jobs like teaching. It's jobs that are traditionally held by women, which are seen as caregiving, nurturing, and that somehow I think in the grand scheme of things, people or employers have tended to think that, well, that's sort of women's role, natural role. Why should they really be compensated fairly for that? But Senator Harkin, to his credit, recognized that this was actually just another form of discrimination and that these are incredibly important jobs. I mean, what could be more important than teaching? I mean, the next generation of Americans, giving them the skills to be able to live a full life. I can't think of anything really that's more important than that. And yet we so undervalue teachers in America. So his bill would have given a cause of action that would actually say, if there are two jobs of equal kind of value in terms of the, you know, skills and education and so forth, there should be a cause of action. You should be able to sue and get fair pay. Minnesota has actually adopted such a law for its public employees. And they actually did ended up rectifying the pay levels of different job categories in the state government because they recognized they were underpaying women. And they brought them up closer to where the men are. And so this isn't just a crazy idea. The European Union actually has similar kind of regulations, which would consider disparate treatment is the term that we use in the law when we're talking about a practice that looks neutral on its face, but in fact has a discriminatory impact. So this is disparate treatment directly to say that just because they're women, should be paid less than an equivalent job. So, you know, this is where Senator Harkin was going. And, you know, I hope that we can continue to push for the recognition that it's not a choice to be paid less. It may be a choice to become a nurse, but it's not a choice to be paid less.
Right. So that's an example. Basically, there, as I understand it, there are two types of discrimination. One, the overt kind of discrimination you were talking about before, where someone can just say, that's the way it's going to be. And then this sort of unstated discrimination, which comes from this disparity in the types of work that people gravitate
to. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. And, you know, there are women who do sort of work to get into non-traditional jobs. And then they often face the first kind of discrimination because it's oftentimes very hard. There's a lot of sexual harassment in traditional, you know, in construction, say, where women go into construction. And there are a lot of stories of, you know, just there's lack of support for women in those industries. So you know, there's this sort of hazing process that happens, harassment and so forth, that means that even the women who kind of get their foot in the door to those higher paid jobs often get pushed out really fast.
Again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson. We're talking about her new book, Under the Bus. How about the safety net that's supposed to be there that would allow for women to have something to fall back on when they were experiencing all the things we've been talking about? Is it there?
Well, unfortunately, no. I mean, what we have is a situation where, you know, because, you know, again, because a lot of workers are not protected by the labor laws, they're left out of a lot of these basics, overtime, for example. And overtime, I would say, is something people should understand was not meant to give some workers more money. Really wasn't the intention. The intention was to have workers work fewer hours, to have a more humane work life, to spread the work between more workers because it was meant to be a disincentive to an employer to work somebody to the bone. And so leaving workers out of the overtime laws means that they actually get worked to the bone, right? They get worked way too many hours for anybody to sustain. You know, you hear of home health care aides working over 80 hours a week. You know, while getting paid minimum wage or a little bit above, you know, an incredibly hard life for anyone, and particularly for those women who also have families of their own, of children.
Yeah, you mentioned a woman who literally had to stick her head out the window, wet it down to try to stay awake because
that's right. She was a nanny who, you know, basically the family she lived with wouldn't let her ever leave the house. She was on duty all the time. And if she said she wanted a time off, they'd say, sorry, okay, bye. Get it, look for a new job. She really had no protections. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is this whole group of workers, and it's larger than we think. Mm-hmm. It's larger than we think. But the other piece about the safety net that I think is important to remember is that we have an increasingly large group of contingent workers.
Yes.
And the contingent workforce, and what that really means is they're workers who are in sort of precarious circumstances. They don't necessarily have a job. They are a contractor, right? So they're not an employee technically under the law. They're designated by the company as an independent contractor. For the company, that means all of a sudden they have no liabilities. They're not responsible for any of the worker protections. They don't have to pay into the Social Security tax. They don't have to pay into unemployment insurance. They certainly don't have to pay overtime. They don't have to pay benefits. They don't have to worry about the discrimination laws. And this is a category of worker that has gotten a lot more attention in the context lately of the so-called sharing economy. And I know in Portland here, I think you've just have Uber coming to the city. Well, Uber has been subject to a number of lawsuits, has been accused of misclassifying, that's the sort of technical term, misclassification of its drivers as contractors as opposed to employees. The bottom line for Uber is hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Because they're shifting the cost of everything, gas, vehicle maintenance, et cetera, beyond the basics of overtime, minimum wage, et cetera, onto the worker. And in cases of independent contractors, it can often mean, and for low-wage workers generally, it can often mean onto the state and to the taxpayer because many low-wage workers earn so little money. This is the case in Walmart has been accused of this, paying their workers so little money that they actually need to get on food stamps or other government benefits just to make the very basic standard of living. And so the safety net is really being unraveled because we have this growing group of contingent workers. And, you know, oftentimes there are younger workers who and Portland may have quite a number, I'm guessing, who think there's a kind of romantic sort of aspect to sitting in some great cafe and working on a blog, getting free Wi-Fi, and having various contracts. The problem of that, though, is that at the end of the day, they're not putting anything aside. They're not getting any money put into Social Security. They're not getting a pension. And at a certain point in time, those workers might want to have children. And at a certain point in time, they will need to retire or they'll want to retire. And they're just going to come up so short because there has been no safety net built for those people. And so this is where I think, you know, with Under the Bus, I wanted to come to the point where we really realize that we have this enormous need to re-examine how our safety net is crafted, how it is so full of holes, and how do we sew them up so that we actually have a net that people don't fall through.
Right, and I do want to get into the remedies that you talk about. And we did talk about the Fair Pay Act. You also talked about raising the minimum wage and how relevant it is to this discussion. And what do you think should be done regarding tipped workers?
Well, I think the best thing to do is what Oregon has done, which is just to get rid of it. There is no reason. Actually, some restaurants are independently, progressive restaurant owners are getting rid of tips altogether. And that is a very interesting approach. To set a high wage, I mean, this happens in other countries. They don't have tipping in Europe, typically. They have decent wages for waiters and so it actually becomes a job, a profession that people can have, and it's not something that you do as just a stop gap kind of measure, which is how we tend to think about it in the United States, as somebody's going to school at night, you know, and waits tables just to fill in. Well, actually, a lot of people need their wages because that's their profession. And we need to start thinking about work in the restaurant industry as a profession. And pay people accordingly. So I think the first thing is to get rid of the tipped wage and at least get people up to a minimum wage. And then we need to think about, you know, a much more humane way of structuring our wages. And that is a living wage, not a minimum wage, but a living wage.
You say that, as many have written, unions are on the decline, but you see hope in the rise of worker centers.
That's right. Unions have been actually... And I, you know, hope your listeners will appreciate this, but they're not often given credit for the work that they've done to help limit the wage gap between men and women. But in the unionized sectors, and particularly in public employment, that's where the narrowest gap exists, because unions have done their best to both ensure that categories of jobs that are dominated by women are paid more, and also that women have more access to the top jobs, and that the benefits are far more robust in terms of paid family leave, in terms of paid sick leave, in terms of vacation days. And so the decline of the unions is particularly hard on women, and it is unfortunate. But what has been very interesting and inspiring is to see the rise, in some cases, of worker centers and worker-driven advocacy really ground up led often by women of color, in the context of the domestic workers efforts, in the context of the restaurant industry efforts, in the context of farm workers. And you see people coming together, and the worker centers are very interesting because they're really a living enterprise where people come for all sorts of services. And I had an opportunity to meet with a domestic workers group in Maryland at CASA of Maryland, where it was, the women came in regularly. It was kind of a support group. They talked about their problems, but they got counseling on immigration issues. They got help with English language. There were childcare assistance. There was legal representation. But then basically there was also help for them in their struggles if there were issues in their employment. And so it was really a very meaningful experience for me to be able to sit in with them and hear them talk about what was going on in their lives and their jobs, and to see that these women have come together to support each other on so many levels. And they talked about, which was really fascinating to me, and I describe this in the book, Under the Bus, how they had recently gone to Annapolis, which is the capital of Maryland, and they had lobbied for the minimum wage increase. And they were describing how disappointed they were that while the minimum wage was increased in Maryland, the tipped level was left at $2.13 an hour. Mm. And none of these women were in the tipped employment category, but they were there to rally for their sisters. And I would just say, people, again, we mentioned this before, but 3/4 of tipped employees are women. So they really are talking about their sisters. And they were so upset that injustice had been done, that even in the progressive state of Maryland, they had, because of the same kind of deal making, the restaurant industry came in and they have bags of cash, they bring it around, they talk to lawmakers, and they got their way. And those women who were trying to make a living waiting tables, working in salons, were left at $2.13 an hour. But I was so impressed with the solidarity and the passion, the compassion, and the amazing commitment of these women that is going to drive, I think, change in our society.
And you, in that answer, you mentioned another aspect of things I didn't want to forget, which is childcare, mm-hmm. and how it is an issue that's another layer of the situation.
Childcare in this country is an embarrassment and abomination. It was really, you know, I think that many people sort of in the upper middle class think it's just a huge cost center. It's expensive, but they don't think about it too much. Because childcare in this country, in the private context, averages the cost of in-state college tuition. So we have to think about what that means, even for middle-class families, to start thinking about paying college tuition when your child is 2 years old, 1.5, 1 year old. And you've got to be thinking about saving enough money to be able to pay childcare from that early time all the way through college. And so I think, you know, it's a real struggle. But it's also, you know, we have an incredibly poorly subsidized childcare system for the very poor. And what I mean by poorly subsidized, I mean we have only 18% of children who are eligible under the guidelines. Their families are so poor, they're eligible. Only 18% of those children actually can get into those programs because we just don't fund them. And so, you know, this is an area where I did a fair amount of research and you know, came up with a few shocking things. One is our government tracks child care arrangements. One of the categories they track is called self-care. And that's what it is. It's exactly what it sounds. It's kind of a euphemism, but it's self-care, meaning parents go to work, child is left alone. Mm. You know, people call those latchkey kids. The federal government doesn't call them latchkey kids. They call them in self-care. But that's, you know, an incredible thing to think about for our society, because children in self-care can harm themselves, get in trouble of all kinds. They're certainly not being stimulated and educated. And the statistics are incredible for what happens for children who are either in self-care or in poor care, and what that means for our economy. If we want to just think very clinically and not as a human, but we just want to think, what does this mean for our economy? It's bad for our economy. It's bad for our economy. It costs a lot of money not to take care of kids right from the beginning. It leads to higher criminality, higher pregnancy rates, higher dropout rates, all of the rest. Definitely lots of data on this. You can look at it in my book. But as human beings, I think we also really, this is where, you know, I hope we come from initially, is to think about what that means for that child. And those parents who have to go to work thinking how worried they are that they're, and they, you know, and there's a story. There was a woman in North Carolina, minimum wage worker working at McDonald's, who could not afford in-state college tuition on a McDonald's minimum wage, you know, obviously. And so she tried different arrangements. She left her child in the park across the street from the minimum wage, and, you know, trying to figure out ways to check up on her daughter. And, you know, she gets arrested. She got arrested for child neglect. And what does that do? She loved her child, and now they're going to be separated, foster care, et cetera. You know, all the, you know, the issues that the mother will now face in the legal system, that can't be our child care system. So, you know, we did try once. There was a bill passed by Congress that in the early 70s, it was actually going to provide a robust federal child care program. I mean, it's hard for us to believe that this was actually something our government was capable of doing, but they did, and it passed. And so you wonder where it is now. Well, what happened was Phyllis Schlafly, the anti-feminist general, got involved, and after she had worked to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment, wanted to stop this terrible thing that would have provided child care in America. And she went on a rampage, and she organized all sorts of right-wing groups, including a group called the 4Ws, which stands for Women Who Want to Be Women. Because I guess women who want to be women think child care in America is a form of communism. And that's actually what they called it, socialism, communism. Mm-hmm. You know, these crazy feminists, they want to take our husbands' jobs away. They want to end, you know, the America as we know it and love it. So they lobbied, and President Nixon vetoed that bill. But we came so close to actually having a system. And you think about what that would mean for people's lives now. What would that mean, particularly for low-wage workers, where child care is, for most families with children, a third of their costs. So it's rent, food, child care. So a third of their costs. If that wasn't there, just think of what their lives would be like. Just think of whether they could actually start to have opportunities in the world, and think of what that would mean for their children.
And then one solution, you say, is making sure that the rules from the 19th century defining employee are modernized to reflect the realities of the contemporary employment relationship. Can you explain that a little?
So we're getting into kind of technical employment law, but this is, there's the history of our, how we describe an employee is really based on this kind of master-servant law. It doesn't look at the realities of the economic control that an employer has. And so what we need to do is bring that up to date and say, you know, if somebody's really spending most of their time working for one company, they're an employee. But we haven't done that. There was a big study done in the 90s under President Clinton where they grappled with this, and they came to the recognition that the law was so out of date, and there were more and more workers were being called independent contractors, and it was undermining all this progressive legislation because more and more workers were no longer covered by those laws. And then, of course, we did nothing about it. You know, there have started to be some new and interesting proposals which would actually take some of the benefits out of the employment context and start making it kind of more like a Social Security system where people had portable benefits, where you pay into a fund and, you know, there's a payroll tax deduction and the state matches it. And it's not dependent on the employer, which would no longer have that incentive to play around with legal terminology and say you're not an employee, you're a contractor. Whatever you are, you're a person and you're entitled to health care. You're entitled to overtime. You're entitled to join a union, and you're entitled to your other benefits that any other worker is entitled to. And so I think that is a place where we need to go as a society, because there are too many tricks that get played with these antiquated definitions. And I don't think we're going to go towards tinkering with those definitions. I think it probably goes in a better direction to start looking at how do we structure our benefits so that they can't be wiggled out of by an employer that wants to basically make a higher profit than they otherwise would.
And another one that I just wanted you to touch on is developing legal tools to address occupational segregation and help women move into non-traditional fields. Mm-hmm.
Well, so, you know, addressing occupational segregation on the one hand involves the kind of legal tools that that were included in the Fair Pay Act, which we discussed, that Senator Harkin had pushed for, which would ensure that there was a legal mechanism to challenge underpayment of certain categories of work. What happens in those cases, if you actually lift up the wages of those types of jobs, men want to have them too. All of a sudden, you have greater diversity in those jobs. But on the other side, when we want to enable women to move into jobs that women have not traditionally been in, we need to have all sorts of incentive programs. I mean, one is helping women get into them, apprenticeship programs, other types of ways of reaching women to make them understand that these jobs are available. The STEM programs, the science, technology, engineering, and math, on the sort of more professional side, to reach young girls to start with, to give them the confidence and encouragement to believe that these are the types of careers that they can pursue. And then we need to have really strong legal enforcement. Because if we don't start cracking down on employers that allow blatant sexual harassment in the workplace, that allow women to be derided and abused, then women aren't going to want to go into those jobs, even as much as they might love to be a mechanic or a mechanical engineer or a physicist or what have you, a truck driver. You know, that has to be sort of, the access has to be coupled with an enforcement structure.
Caroline Fredrickson, one of the points that you make in the book is that when you look at how American workers fare in this world, particularly women and women of color, when you look at that in an international context, we don't look so great. And you talk about shaming in an international context. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, there are a number of the international treaties that the United States has just not signed on to, which would protect women against discrimination. But more importantly, I think there have been a lot of international efforts led by workers and often women to join hands to raise up the standards. And the domestic workers are an amazing example of this, who worked with their sisters around the world to lobby for UN protections to have a standard adopted that would give certain rights to domestic workers, a bill of rights of essence. They then used that to lobby in the United States. And in New York, this is an incredible, great story where they brought over some of the commissioners from the UN to hold a hearing about the standard of life for domestic workers in New York and shamed them. This was after the UN had adopted this standard. And they shamed them. As a result, New York then, as part of this, adopted a New York Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And it was partly shining a light on us where we are below the standards of the world. This is something on family leave, which I like to mention frequently, which is we are one of the only countries in the world, only countries in the world, that don't have some form of paid family leave. Yes, we have unpaid family leave for a small sector of the workforce. We have paid family leave for a very small sector of the workforce. And they tend to be high-earning professionals and mostly men. So, you know, there's a little bit of debate about exactly which other countries, but there has, you know, I've seen listed Papua New Guinea, but I think they've fixed it. They may offer a slight amount of paid family leave in Swaziland and Lesotho. And I think that the United States, as a wealthy country, needs to do better.
As we wrap up this interview, Caroline, what gives you hope in this area?
Well, the hope that I've seen is really the activism that is often led by women of color around the country, addressing the well-being of domestic workers, of farm workers, of restaurant workers, and to see that there have actually been changes made. Oregon is a good example, where the state adopted several improvements to its laws in the last legislative session, and there's more on the books. I know the minimum wage is still waiting. There's a fight to increase the minimum wage in Oregon. But the workers that have organized locally, to both at the state and local level, to increase the minimum wage in Seattle and in other parts of the country where they have gotten paid family leave, I am inspired by that because I don't think politics happens, or at least good politics, from the top. It happens bottom up. And the way we make positive change in this country is by organizing at the grassroots level and by pressuring. Even the best politician needs pressure to do the right thing. And so, you know, I think Oregon is a good example, and Portland, terrific in terms of some of the laws that you have adopted. But the organizing at the local level is what gives me optimism and hope. And I hope that in Under the Bus, I inspire people to take action themselves in their own communities, to start fighting for paid sick leave, to start fighting for raising the minimum wage. But at least, the very least, to recognize that we have let so many workers be unprotected for way too long.
Well, thank you so much. I really admire your passion and your work on this book. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Kathleen Stevenson, and this has been Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. My guest was Caroline Fredrickson, and we've been talking about her new book, Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Thank you for listening. Lori Dameron, the creator of What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth. She is performing this multimedia environmental concert here in Portland this Sunday, October 4th, from 5 to 7 or 8 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza at 3552 North Mississippi Avenue. And she joins us now from Missoula, Montana. Is that where you are, Lori?
That's correct.
Wow. Tell us about your show. It raises awareness on environmental issues. Tell us a little more about what it's like to experience What Can I Do? Spaceship Earth.
The term I've been using lately is increasing mindfulness, you know, because so many people are into yoga and things like that these days. And, you know, every action we take has a result. It's also about our disposable society. We're so used to convenience, and it's all about these little things that people don't often think about. So recycle and compost is great, but reduce and reuse, so much more important.
And so in your show, how do you express that?
I, you know, try to get people to think about what can I do, or what can they do. There's a segment on energy conservation, water, plastic bottled water, and non-recyclable paper cups, coffee cups. And, you know, just when you think about all the energy it takes to create these things, and especially plastic, the main ingredient is petroleum, of course, and then the energy to get it here, and even the energy to get rid of, recycling and composting, it takes energy to get rid of, and so reduce and reuse.
You also feature photography, so I'm thinking that's a slideshow and music and spoken word.
Yeah. Oh, the first video is kind of a satirical song I wrote many years ago called Change in Mother Nature. And then the second one is Dying of Human Souls. I actually won the EPA Environmental Protection Agency office in Denver, had a video and art contest this Earth Day. And I won the video contest for The Dying of Human Souls. Then I Believe features the photography of my dear friend Carl Snyder in Colorado. And Utah Dream is another video, and it's just pictures I've taken over the years. And Utah is my favorite spot on the planet. And then the last video, What Can I Do, features Colorado's John Fielder, who's pretty famous there. He's, you know, made about 4 or 5 coffee table books of photography.
How did your project come about? What was your inspiration?
I've been talking about environmental issues my whole music career, so since the early 90s. But on New Year's Eve of 2012, I had a spiritual coach for a while, and she said, Lori, I want you to think about what you want to do this year and what's the most important thing to you. And without even thinking, I said, this beautiful earth. So I had written the song, What Can I Do, previously to that, but I got thinking that, gee, with live music and multimedia and art and photography, I thought that I could attract larger audiences and make a greater impact.
In your video, you talk about your own background growing up outside of Cleveland, I think.
Yeah, it's a little town called Berea. I was born there in 1960, and in the 60s, the Cuyahoga River was so polluted, he used to catch on fire. And that I remember doing art projects in elementary school on that. I remember I drew a picture of a coal plant with the smoke spewing out. It's probably like eight years old or something.
And so the burning of the river made an impact on many kids in grade school at the time.
Yeah, well, the great thing is, in 1969, the 13th time it caught on fire, it attracted the attention of Time magazine, and they did a whole story, and that's when people started, you know, getting their awareness raised on environmental issues. And actually, that also spurred the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and even the EPA.
If people maybe can't come to the show but would like to hear more about your work or see your work, how would they connect with it?
Probably the best way is my Facebook page, and it's What Can I Do, Spaceship Earth, No Spaces.
I'm speaking with Lori Dameron. Sunday, October 4th, she will be performing what we've been talking about, this multimedia environmental concert at Mississippi Pizza at 3552 North Mississippi Avenue. And the time on that is 5 p.m. on 7 or 8 p.m. She will be wrapping that up. Also, you have a guest coming with you performing. Is that right, Lori?
Eva Riversong is opening the show. She's a member of Portland's Soul Nectar Band.
Okay.
And you can find them on Facebook, too.
And as we go out, we are going to hear some of your song, I Believe. Do you want to introduce this song and some thoughts about it?
Yes, actually, I wrote that in 1995 for the 25th anniversary of Earth Day. I thought that was special, so I wrote that song.
So we will be hearing that and wish you the best, Lori. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I so appreciate you giving me a call this morning.
Well, it occurred to me this morning as I prayed for love that it's hard to believe in anything. Today the world just moves so fast, we've got no time to sing. Computer addiction, too much work and too much greed, no time to even think. Mobile phones distracting from our feelings, our presence on the brink. What do we believe in? Is there something more precious than gold? What do we believe in? Is there something in our hearts that we hold? Uncaring corporations flaunting power and might, what's in their way they just erase? Raping rainforests, destroying life we can never replace. If we could see it with our eyes, I'm sure we'd feel it with our hearts. There's a stranglehold on the earth. All we need to do is believe and figure out what it's worth. The money God's taken our souls. I don't know about a lot of things, but some things I just know. I believe in something greater. I believe in love. I believe in all of nature, in something beyond and above. I believe
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Zakir Hussain, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. Zakir Hussain is most well known as a tabla player, but he will be exploring the impact jazz has had on Western and Indian music with special guests, including Shankar Madhadevan and Dave Holland. Again, that's Zakir Hussain, Wednesday, October 7th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, 1037 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:58 a.m. Coming up at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with Palestinian community organizer and Amnesty International prisoner of conscience Bassem Tamimi and excerpts from the documentary Occupation 101 about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Eric Tegetthoff speaks with journalist and novelist Hector Tobar about his latest book, Deep Down Dark, the untold stories of 33 men buried in a Chilean mine and the miracle that set them free. At 11:30, Neela Banerjee from Inside Climate News investigates the world's biggest oil company, ExxonMobil. Starting in the 1970s, Exxon knew their product would damage the climate but chose to fund denial. How is it possible for you to hear about all of this? It's because of the members of the KBOO Foundation who have given their support in our recent fall membership drive and before, and hopefully beyond as well. If you did not take advantage of that opportunity, you can still remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says donate today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, September 30th, 2015, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Coming up, today's guest is George Edwardson, Vice President of the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, people whose whole way of living, traditions, all of it, is literally melting away. And I use that word literally correctly in this case. It is melting away. They're hunting, fishing. Even, it's not just a question of ice melting.